We'll be speaking on the anatomy of halacha, the history of the understanding of the human body in rabbinic literature. Rabbi Dr. Eber Reichman is an associate professor of emergency medicine and associate professor in the Division of Education and Bioethics at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine of Yeshiva University, where he teaches Jewish medical ethics. He received his rabbinic ordination from the Rabbi Yitzhak Elchanan Theological Seminary of Yeshiva University and writes and lectures internationally in the field of Jewish medical ethics. He is the recipient of a Kornfeld Foundation and has been a member of the advisory boards of the Institute of Genetics and Public Policy, the New York Organ Donor Network, the Halachic Organ Donor Society, and the Rabbinical Council of America. His research is devoted to the interface of medical history and Jewish law. As for the YU student body, Rabbi Dr. Reichman has been a mentor for the Yeshiva University Student Medical Ethics Society since its inception in 2005. In this 1 year of my being a part of the society, I have been witness to how special and important individuals such as him can be. In that manner, I would like to thank our presidents, Daniel Elephant and Rachel Blinnick, and my co-host of this event, Dina Gopez, for making this event happen in that manner. Without further ado, by Dr. Edmund.
Thank you so much, Ari. That's a beautiful introduction. Thank you to Ari and Dina and Rachel and Daniel for your extraordinary work. And as I said, the last event, you can pretty much ignore most of the introduction. The only thing which is really meaningful to me is my mentorship of the Medical Ethics Society, which is really an extraordinary organization, which I am absolutely delighted to be a part of. How many people here are first event? We're all second timers at least, third timers? That's great. Maybe a couple first timers. Okay, great. Dina, first time, and you're organizing. Amazing. The Medical Ethics Society, you know, started in 2005. Yona was one of the people who started it. Yona Bardos, who should be here tonight, Aaron, but is not here. And since its inception in 2005, it has really mushroomed into a really extraordinary organization. And Rachel and Daniel, and now at the helm, have continued the tradition and really run with it, and run some fantastic events. And this is really one of them. It's really wonderful to bring you guys to the Yeshiva University Museum. Unfortunately, there's not enough connection between YU and Stern and the YU Museum. For how many people is this their first time coming to the YU Museum? So we have somebody who's actually been here before. I thought it was going to be all hands up, but a few people have actually been here before. I'd like to just organize the evening for us tonight. I'm going to speak for about 35 minutes or so. You guys can feel free to cut me off at exactly 35 minutes, no problem. And then we'll go in to see the exhibit, which is a really excellent exhibit. I'm going to be able to speak to you guys for a few minutes at the beginning of the exhibit, and then you guys will be on your own to go through the exhibit. It has a wealth of information on it. The exhibit really focuses on one century, focuses on 1860 to 1960, and some fascinating medical developments by Jews in that period of time. What I'd like to focus on is really more historical, going much farther back than the exhibit, really a supplement to the exhibit. And that's something which is really fundamental to the understanding of science and medicine. And that's the understanding of the human body itself. How many people here are interested in medicine, by the way? A fair amount of people. Excellent. Okay, I'll make sure to put this on your applications, as we'll all do. Great. If I were to ask you, we're going to start with some basics of the human body. How many people here have taken anatomy? Anybody taken anatomy? How many limbs are there in the human body?
248.
What did you say?
I said 248.
248. Excellent. Excellent. How do we know there are 248 limbs in the body? Where does that number come from?
Ramach Evarim.
Mishaberach. Ramach Evarim. Excellent. Excellent. So the number of limbs in the body comes actually, let me just read you this great thing. one of my favorites. Ramach Evarim is 248 limbs, comes from originally the Mishnah and Ohalos. And what you are seeing here is the Mishnah and Ohalos. Perek Vav, and it reads as follows: Masayim v'arboim u'shmona evorim ba'adam. There are 248 limbs in the man. Shloshim efisus regel, 30 in the foot. Shisha b'chol etzba, 6 in each digit. Asar b'karsol, shnayim b'shok, chamisha b'arkuva, echad b'yerech, shlosha b'kutlis, etc., etc. Now, why on earth is the Mishnah and Olos enumerating the limbs of the body for us? Anybody have any idea?
In case there's an ohel over a bone, that would cause someone to become tummy ache.
Excellent. So this is not an anatomy textbook. The Mishnah and the Gemara are not medical books that you're going to look to for medical knowledge. It discusses medical knowledge in as much as it has halachic relevance. So what's the halachic relevance of anatomy? The halachic relevance is exactly as you mentioned. We have a halacha that if you're under the same enclosure with a body, with a corpse, the corpse generates tuma. There's different forms of tuma. There's tumas maga, tumas masa, which is touching a mace, touching a dead body, supporting the weight of a dead body, even if you're not touching it, and tumas ohel. Tumas ohel is tuma under the same enclosure. Now, what generates tumas ohel? So it's not just a full body, a full corpse, but the majority, the robe of a corpse, also generates tuma. The robe in volume of a corpse and the robe in number of limbs of a corpse. So in order to know what robe of a number of limbs is, you need to know the total number of limbs. Hence, the Mishnah enumerates for us the 248 limbs. Now, if those what exactly is an aver is part of our discussion. And here we have an early account, one of the earliest accounts of anatomical dissection actually in recorded history, from the Gemara in Bechoros. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Ma'ase b'talmidav shel Rabbi Shmuel, the students of Rabbi Shmuel, Sheshalku zona achas, Shenizchayva sreifa lamelech. Now, shalku is a debate what the etymology of shalku is, but for our intents and purposes, we'll say dissected. Probably means boiled the body. Shalku zona achas, Shenizchayva sreifa lamelech. So there was a woman who was convicted of a capital crime by the king. It wasn't in a Jewish context, but the students of Rabbi Shmuel, we're talking the sage of Rabbi Shmuel, they dissected a human body. So they performed a dissection. Badku umatsu ba. So how many limbs would you expect them to find? We just learned in the Mishnah Olos, there's Ramah Heverim, there's 248. So what number do they come to?
252.
Masayim hamishim shnai. 252. So they came to a different number, which is quite fascinating. Why did they do the dissection? So they probably did it to verify the number in Mishnah and Olos. Yet they came to a different number. This is not a picture of Rabbi Shmuel doing a dissection. This is a picture of Dr. Tulp, the famous. This is a Rembrandt. And when you walk into the gallery, you will see an original Rembrandt in the gallery, a depiction of a Jewish physician, Ephraim Bueno. By the very one and only Rembrandt. Rembrandt actually depicted a number of Jewish figures throughout his career. But it is interesting that they found a number of different limbs. Now, the mere fact that they found a number of different limbs tells us one very important thing. An aver is clearly not a bone. Let me explain. So what are the, before I get to that point, Emelhem Shema Be'isha Badakta. So that's a key point. So the Gemara answers, why did they get 252 and the Mishnah and Olos is 248? So they say, well, Mishnah and Olos was talking about a male individual. Here, the 252 is a female individual. So that key fact tells us that an aver is not a bone, because the bones in the female body and the male body are exactly the same number. There's no difference whatsoever. Now, the skeleton of the male and the skeleton of the female do have some differences. The main differences are in the angle, the curvature of the spine, the pelvis, but not in the number of bones. So an aver is likely not a number of bone. Is likely not a bone. And somebody mentioned the Mishaberach. This Gemara is the source for the minhag of saying two Mishaberachs, one for the man and one for the woman. Now, how many people have that in their shuls, have a minhag to say Mishaberach for the man separate from the woman? So a couple of you have that minhag. Some people say it all together in one. Some people say it separate. Why is it separate? It's separate because according to the Gemara, there's one line that's different in the two Mishaberachs. You say Yishlach Lo for the man, you say Yishlach Lo Meher Ufu Shlim Min HaShamayim LiRamach Eivarav V'Shasagi Dav. For the woman, you say l'chol eivareha u'l'chol gideha. You don't use ramach. Why don't you use ramach for the woman's mishabera? Because based on the Gemara, a woman doesn't have ramach. A woman has 252, not 248. You're going to ask me, what are these 248? Can we identify them? That's what we're going to talk about in a minute. Not in too much detail, don't worry, guys. The shesah gidav is 365 gidim. Now, what's a gid? You wouldn't have an idea what a gid is.
Sinew.
So you know the translation is sinew. If you can tell me what a sinew is, I'll give you $5. What's a sinew? Tendons, nerves, arteries, veins. Big debate in medical and halachic literature exactly what a gid is. And while many, many people have tried to figure out the 248 limbs, as we'll see in a minute, Not as many have ventured into the area of trying to figure out the 365 gidim. But when we're going to talk about the origins of anatomical dissection in a minute, but when people began to realize, many, many centuries after the Mishnah and the Gemara were written, and anatomical dissection became popular, and again, we're going to get back to that in a minute, people began to realize that the 248 didn't necessarily jive with anatomical dissection. That if you performed a dissection of the human body, it wasn't so easy to figure out exactly what they were talking about in the Mishnah, and it didn't always arrive at 248. So here you have one example. This is Mate Dan, the Kuzari Sheni Vedav Nieto, who's a remarkable figure from this early Renaissance period of time. And he writes, "B'mispar evareha adam yesh k'tzas hefresh ben chazal v'hamenatchim." Because there's a difference between what Chazal account for 248 and the Menateach, or the surgeons, the anatomists. V'chein b'mispar ha'atzamas, and so too the number of bones. Aval ein lachush lehefresh habinya. Don't worry about the difference between the two. Yan ish l'darko panu b'lishi akhishu zedze. Because in the halachic literature, in the Mishnah and Olos, it wasn't intended to be anatomical, it was intended to be halachic. And the definition of an aver is different than the definition of a bone for anatomical purposes. Since that period of time, many, many people have tried to figure out how do you get 248? Because when you're talking about theory, philosophy, that's one thing. But when you're talking about the fact that the students of Rabbi Shmuel dissected a human body and came up with a number 252, they're obviously looking at something. It wasn't imaginary. And when the Mishnah and Olos enumerates the exact numbers, the number of ribs, the number of bones in each limb, they're looking at something factual. So what were they looking at? What did they define as this Ramach? So here you have a fascinating example of Dr. Yehuda Lev Katznelson, who was a Russian physician in the late 1800s, who wrote an entire sefer called Ramach Evarim. And the year of publication, interestingly enough,
1888.
Tav Resh Mem Ches. So I wonder how many years he waited to publish this. So he wrote an entire sefer, and he claimed, actually, based on the developmental stages of bone, that it was likely a teenager that the Gemara is talking about, and that they boiled the body. And he claims, which is classic embryology, that the bones fuse at different stages of development. So when you're young, your long bone, say your humerus or your femur, is comprised of a diaphysis and two epiphyses. You guys remember those words from basic biology? And it's, the bone is partially cartilage and not completely ossified. It's not completely bone. So if you boiled a long bone in a teenager, it would really be three bones instead of one. Right? Because the two epiphyses would become separate. And he has a very lengthy, detailed analysis, and he actually comes to a pretty close to this number, 248. This was another book written in the late 1800s, roughly around the same period of time, where a Jewish physician by the name of Binyamin Sharshevsky wrote a book called Masechet Nituach in Hebrew for the Jewish population, and the number of bones that he enumerated was different than the 248. And this was a book for public consumption, and your average Jew was a little concerned about the fact that it says 248 in the Mishnah, and lo and behold, I have a book that I'm now opening up where it doesn't equal 248. So this is the review of this book in a journal called Hamelitz, where the author writes, "Lo nichechad mimeni ki b'minyan ha'atzamos sheba adam mishnas chasoseres l'mishnas chazal." He goes, "It didn't elude me when I read your book, which I'm now writing a review about, that you don't have the same number as Chazal." And he actually writes, The harbe yagati litaritz hadivarim shelote machlokes ben chazal ben chachme hanituach. I've tried very hard to make sure that there should be no conflict between the words of Chazal and what the anatomists say and the reality of anatomical dissection. And what does he say? Velo also biyadi kehogan. I have not been successful. And he actually writes the importance of these kinds of svarim in general for the rabbis to have correct factual anatomical information. So that's the history of the 248, and to be honest, there still hasn't been a real satisfactory answer as to what exactly these 248 are. But I'd like to take you now to the halachic world of anatomical dissection, and we now talk about one of the most famous tshuvas in medical halachic literature, and that's the tshuva of the Noda Yehuda. We're going to talk about it in a little different way than you're probably normally used to it, for those of you who are familiar with it. Noda Yehuda lived in the 18th century. Rebbe Landa lived in Prague, and this tshuva that we are about to read is the very first tshuva in the entire halachic corpus that deals with anatomical dissection and autopsy. So what we're going to talk about is why it's only in the 18th century that you have the very first tshuva by a posek in the Shilas and Tshuvas about anatomical dissection. But let's turn to the Shila for a second. Reading from the second line, Al das kondreis asher shalach elai, regarding the letter that you sent me, Shabbat Mekila Kadosh London, from the question that came from London, B'maase she'ira sham, be'echad she'chala, now this I want you guys to pay attention to this phrase, a patient who fell ill with the following medical condition, Choli ha'even b'kiso. What do you think that is, guys? What's your diagnosis?
Kidney stone.
A stone, right. But where is that stone?
It's pocket.
It's in a pocket, excellent. Front pocket, back pocket.
Gallstone?
Gallbladder, gallstone, excellent thought.
Kidney stone,
excellent thought.
Bladder stone.
Now, the answer actually is bladder stone. Now, you like this cartoon? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then you've got gallstones, kidney stones, and bladder stones. Welcome to the Stone Age. Now, the truth is that the reason why we know it's bladder stone is from a historical analysis of this tshuva. Gallstones weren't even identified in the human being until the 1500s, 1600s. The first gallbladder surgery wasn't until the 1800s. But stones, when he says, Chole ha'even, be stone, at his period in history, there's only one stone he could possibly have been referring to, and that's the bladder stone. Now, bladder stones were known since antiquity. And in fact, Celsus, who's writing in the first century of the Common Era, wrote a very detailed analysis how to remove a bladder stone. You make an incision in the perineal area, and you remove the stone. Now, how did they know about these stones? They knew about these stones because they were huge, and you could sometimes feel them, and sometimes part of the stone would come out in the urination, so you'd actually see the stone. And these stones caused tremendous and excruciating pain. And what other operations besides cutting for the stone do you think would have been performed in antiquity? Thoughts?
Hitting the eye and making the stone just come out.
I'm sorry?
Hitting the area. And making
right, so hitting the area would not, I'm sure they would have tried that, but they wouldn't have been successful. Because these stones, this by the way is of the smaller stones, this is about 4 or 5 inches. Now, kidney stones are very common today. I mean, I see kidney stones every day in the ER. Kidney stones are measured in millimeters, yeah. Right? So if I see a kidney stone that's more than 5-6 millimeters, I'm a little concerned that it might not pass on its own. We may need some urological intervention. Bladder stones, which are deposited in the bladder, are in inches. And some of them are as big as softballs. Now, for fascinating reasons, we almost never see bladder stones today. In fact, in the ER, bladder stone isn't even on my differential diagnosis for someone who comes in with abdominal pain. But if I would have been a physician 100 years ago, 200 years ago, bladder stones were extraordinarily common. So most people think it's the Industrial Revolution, major changes in our dietary pattern that changed it. Did you have a question about that?
Did they have some sort of medicine that they were doing?
So medicines, even today there are no medicines to dissolve a stone that size. And heat wouldn't dissolve it. These things are rock hard. None of these things will dissolve it. So they actually used to cut for the stone. So what did they do in this particular case? So they operated, as was the common practice in the 1700s. chatchu kedarka beisik refuah b'maka kazu v'lo also la trufa, and they weren't successful. Umeis, and the patient died. So the context of the tshuva was, this patient died in the course of surgery. Can we now perform an autopsy so that we can better treat patients who present with bladder stones? That was the shot. So, there's lots of halachic analysis and discussion, but my focus today really is on the historical approach. Why is it that the Noda B'Yehuda is the first posek to talk about anatomical dissection? What about the Rambam? The Rambam was a physician. Rambam trained as a physician. Not a single mention in all the works, the medical works, halacha works of the Rambam, of doing a dissection, doing an autopsy. Yeah.
Well, this is after the Renaissance, where the human body was, again, fascination, so maybe anatomy was...
Excellent. So that's really our answer, as we'll see the history of anatomical dissection. The Shulchan Aruch also, 1500s, mentions everything about the human body, exhuming the human body, avelus of the human body, dismemberment of the human body, not a single peep about dissection. The entire Shulchan Aruch. Why not? Yeah.
Again, that's, I guess, historically, because you see from, like, Da Vinci, he got in a lot of trouble for drawing anatomical models and diagrams, so I guess there was a general breakdown in society, specifically religion, which allowed for them to actually perform autopsies.
Very good. Excellent. You guys are all correct. So and we'll see in a moment that autopsies were not routinely performed, despite what many people believe probably would have been the case. Actually, it was not the case. Fascinating, just another corollary tshuva, which is by Rabbi Yaakov Emden, to confirm the fact that we're talking about bladder stones specifically, and only bladder stones, it could have been nothing else. It's a fascinating passage by Rabbi Yaakov Emden, more Ritzia in Hilchos Shabbos, and he writes about this stone. He goes, he's talking about multiple different surgical procedures. It's a fascinating passage on amputation. He actually says you can compel somebody to undergo amputation against their will. I don't know if you guys heard about this case in Israel within the last few months. There was a young girl who had a gangrenous limb, and she refused to have the operation, and they actually forced her to undergo the operation, and the judge, in his decision, mentioned Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Only in Israel, as they say.
Wow.
So he said, some people undergo a following procedure. To save themselves from tremendous pain and suffering, like those who submit to the surgery of Evan Shebekis, which is, we now know, a bladder stone. Ubegin, and in the male reproductive organ, so that's clearly talking about the stone. But Chatzatz HaKleos is in the kleos of the kidneys. This is the urogenital system. HaKo'emoson ma'od v'tzar koshe kemavis. The pain is like death. Has anybody here had a kidney stone? You want to test how painful it was?
Very painful. Very, very painful.
So they say that the pain, I actually had a kidney stone, and I'm telling you, it was literally the most excruciating pain I could ever imagine, and 10 times more. They say it's the male equivalent to childbirth. And it's just amazing.
How big was yours?
We'll talk about that after. And they undergo the surgery, and why? Because sometimes they get cured from the surgery. However, he comments, and when we're inside, he said, it's a very risky surgery, and you shouldn't do this surgery. It's usher to do a surgery to remove the bladder stone because the risk is too high. And he says, Shabbos or not Shabbos? The context here is Shabbos. But he says, I don't care if it's Shabbos or not Shabbos, and I don't care if you're suffering deathly pains, you can't undergo surgery for the bladder stone.
Interesting.
Now, why not? How risky is surgery for the bladder stone? So here you have people undergoing surgery for a bladder stone. This gentleman is Frère Jacques, Father Jacques. You ever hear Frère Jacques? So before he had his religious epiphany, Frère Jacques was a wandering lithotomist. Now, for those of you who don't, you wouldn't expect to know this term. When you get to medical school, you'll know this term. When women in childbirth, they bring the knees all the way up for the baby to deliver. That's called a lithotomy position. The reason it's called a lithotomy position is because that's the same position that they put people in when they remove a bladder stone. They bring the knees all the way up. It's called the lithotomy position and lithotomy means removal of the stone. This man, Frère Jacques, was a wandering lithotomist. Why, you will ask me, was he wandering? Because his mortality rate for the surgery was 50%. That means that 50% of the people he operated on died. So he ain't going to be staying in one place for too long. And that was the state of medicine in the 1700s. This is before anesthesia. This is before antibiotics. So a lot of people died from post-op infection. And here you have, I just have a theory. I haven't actually correlated it. But literally in London, where the Shiloh to the Nota Behuda was presented, this is literally the same, within a few years of the Tshuva to Shiloh to the Nota Behuda, they were doing experimental surgical procedures on removal of the bladder stone. This is one case. You have to look a little closely because this is Old English, so it's not so easy to read. But it looks like a remarkable cafe. It's not a remarkable cafe.
Case.
It's a remarkable case. They have a remarkable cafe downstairs, by the way. Remarkable case of a person cut for the stone in the New Way, commonly called the lateral, by William Cheselden. William Cheselden was actually a very prominent surgeon at that time. So I believe that they were doing experimental surgeries in London. That's why they wanted to do an autopsy to see if the experimental surgery worked properly or not. That's just my theory. Take it or leave it. Now, the history of Bereshus, the folds who have now graced us. We thank you, for joining us. Welcome to our presentation this evening. So, in understanding the history of anatomical dissection, we move to another fascinating area. We shift from now. You guys mentioned the question that I asked you is why is it only the times of Nota Behuda we're asking the question about anatomical dissection? Many of you appropriately said because they weren't doing dissection before that. And the truth of the matter is they really weren't doing much dissection before that. Even Galen, who was one of the and Hippocrates, who were the forerunners of medicine and the grandfathers of medicine for many, many centuries, people studied them. And Galen in particular, his works were studied for over 1,000 years, and he wrote about anatomy, but he dissected animals, not human beings. He actually was a surgeon, he was a physician to the gladiators, so he learned a little cross-sectional anatomy, I guess. But he still learned everything that he learned from animals and not human beings. When did that change? That changed with the work of Vesalius in the Renaissance, in the 1500s. And we're going to talk 2-3 minutes about Vesalius himself and where Vesalius lectured, which is even more fascinating. What you see here is the front page of the work of Vesalius. This is Vesalius, a man of relatively short stature, standing over a human body. And this was the crowd that gathered. In those ages, anatomical dissection was a new and exciting thing. So everybody came to these dissections. It wasn't just medical students. It was the royalty who came. It was the politicians that came. It was people that came from other countries to visit these dissections to learn and understand the human body. And there was a renewed vigor about the understanding of the human body. And if you go to Italy today and you look at the sculptures from that period of time, of the Renaissance, you will see there is extraordinary attention to anatomical detail, every vein in the surface of the body, every muscle and fiber you'll see. Why? Because of this new renewed attention to detail. In this work in the 1500s, considered one of the most extraordinary works in the history of medicine, Vesalius translated his terms into a number of different languages, into Latin, into Greek, and into the following language.
Cool.
What does this say? Translation, anybody?
Heart.
Close. Ha-orti.
Aorta.
The aorta. Correct. So the works of Vesalius actually were in the Hebrew language. And some say that this fellow, he's depicted here, looks like a Jewish-looking guy with a fez and a long beard. Like a nice rubbisher guy. So this they say is Lazarus de Phrygius, probably called Laser and Schulk, he's the one who apparently taught Vesalius the Hebrew for his work. We're not going to discuss it today, because those who are interested, I'm happy to share with you more information, but why Hebrew was an integral part of medical training is a fascinating tangent. The Jews were instrumental in transmitting works from antiquity through the Renaissance by virtue of their translation, and Hebrew was an essential part of medicine at that time. But what's also interesting is not only, for a brief little tangent, not only the history of Vesalius and his anatomical dissection, but the university where Vesalius taught. Vesalius taught at a university called the University of Padua. Now, what was fascinating about the University of Padua is the following. Jews were prohibited from attending any university in the Middle Ages by church law, by papal law. And in fact, when you walk into the gallery to the right, you will see a papal edict which forbids Jews from attending universities. And if you were a Jew who lived in the 1300s, 1400s, 1500s, you were out of luck if you wanted to go to university, and med school, out of the question. And even if you went to medical school, you couldn't get a diploma because you had to avow your belief in Christianity to get a diploma and to get a license. But that changed with the University of Padua. University of Padua, for reasons which are unclear, decided to accept Jews to the university. Fantastic thing for Jews. And as a result, all the Jews who were interested in this kind of training migrated from all over the world to attend the University of Padua. Now, the University of Padua was not your local community college. This was the premier university in Europe. Galileo lectured at the University of Padua. William Harvey lectured at the University of Padua. Vesalius lectured at the University of Padua. So what you had is you had Jews coming literally from the shtetl, knowing nothing, speaking Yiddish from Poland and from Germany, coming to the Harvard of universities back in Europe. So here what you have is something fascinating. First of all, this is your record. Medici, Escherugi, Ebrei, Notarotti, anyone want to read that with me? Now, the University of Padova from 1617 to 1817. This is a registry of all the Jewish students that graduated medical school from the University of Padua from 1617 to 1816. It reads like a who's who of Jewish history. Fascinating, fascinating who attended this university. Tacha Yitzchak, Yitzchak Compranti, Lazaria de Rossi, who wrote amazing historical work. So what you have here is a remarkable document, a remarkable fragment, extraordinarily rare. This is the work of Vesalius in Yiddish.
What?
Yiddish, wow. Vesalius. So you have these guys coming from Poland who couldn't speak the language. They couldn't read the Latin of Vesalius. So they actually had training schools to train these students to accommodate them so they could actually get up to speed, get up to par, to be able to attend the universities and do well in the universities. How were these students received by the Italian community? When they graduated, they had massive parties. They wrote beautiful poems. There's a few of these that are extant, and they're extraordinarily rare. This is Yitzchak Pensili. This is the son of Yitzchak Lompranti, or Shlomo Lompranti, for whom they wrote these magnificent poems with illustrations. This is a poem written by Yehuda Aryeh de Modena in honor of someone who graduated the university. But in their attendance at the university, and this you'll actually see a similar one to this in the gallery, a real diploma from the University of Padua in the gallery when we walk in. The Jews, even though they were allowed to attend, they were not treated equal by any stretch. They had higher fees for attendance. There was clearly discrimination against the Jews. At the first snow of the season, the Jews had to purchase meats for the entire faculty. These bizarre, discriminatory things. But they still let them attend, and they made accommodations for them. And this is one of the accommodations that you will see real-life diploma in just a few minutes. In every diploma that every graduate of every university received, it did not say this. It said, in the name of Jesus. That's what it said. But if you're a Jew graduating from university, you're not having that on your diploma. So they made an accommodation. They changed it. Any Latin speakers here? Does anyone take Latin anymore?
The eternal God.
In the name of the eternal God. Amen. So that change was made, and you will see that in the magnificent... This is a magnificently illustrated diploma. Now, I graduated medical school. I did not get anything that looked like this. I'm a little upset about it. But I've gotten over it. You will also see this book in the exhibit. This is one of the most famous works in the history of Jews in medicine. And that's called Masa Tuvia. Tuvia Rofe graduated the University of Padua. He originally attended a German university. He needed to get special permission from the Pope himself to attend the university, as all Jews did if they wanted to attend the university. He needed to get papal permission. He actually got his from the Duke of Brandenburg via the Pope. But they were so anti-Semitic in Germany, he was the first Jew to ever attend that German university. He left and he went to Padua, where they were much more permissive for the Jews at that time. And he wrote an extraordinary classic work, and this illustration is so famous, not just in Jewish history, but in secular history, where he compares the house to the human being, and he has a key over here in the middle, showing, you know, the heart is the furnace, and the bowels are like the basement where the garbage is, etc. Fascinating. But what he writes in his introduction should be a lesson to all of us. And he writes, he was a learned man, he's originally from Poland, he goes, "Belo ya'ale ale shumadam, b'chol eretz Italia, Polonia, Ashkenaz, and Tzarfat. It should not occur to anybody from all these lands that wants to attend medical school. Lomod chofmas refuah, they shouldn't even start learning medicine. Until they have learned all of the Torah Shebichsav and all the Torah Shebichsav." Mile Kreisa means not just learn a little bit, not just pick up an art scroll for a few minutes. It means literally you learn the entire Torah Shebichsav, Torah Shebichsav, then you are well prepared. With respect to returning to our anatomical dissection, we said that the first tshuva was posed to the Node Behuda, literally the same time period. We have a similar kind of tshuva opposed to none other than Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, we mentioned in the Moro Kutsia, he's the one who talked about the bladder stones in the Moro Kutsia. This is a question posed to Rabbi Yaakov Emden by a Jewish medical student in Germany in the University of Göttingen. And he asked this question, just to give you an idea of how people wrote in these days. Göttingen, Tubi Shvat, Shalom v'yesharav l'rav safra v'tuvayna d'chakima, This is extremely poetic language, obviously an extremely literate, highly intelligent student. So he said, "I am a medical student at University of Göttingen. And now, just now, if you want to study medicine, we now have to do anatomical dissection. In the early part of the 18th century. It's a new thing. Didn't have to do that centuries ago. Am I allowed to do dissection or not?" Fascinating tshuva of the Yaakov Emden. And so writes, "Ko divrei ashoke al dal se chachmas arfua." So is the one who prostrates himself in the doorposts or the doorways of chachmas arfua. Hatzair Binyamin Wolf Ginsburg, the young Binyamin Wolf Ginsburg. What's fascinating is that we know about this Binyamin Wolf Ginsburg from another source. It was customary, and it's still customary to this very day, to write a dissertation when you complete your degree in medicine. Many schools require it. Einstein requires a dissertation. No offense to the Einstein students, but these aren't usually the most extraordinary works that you'll see. Back in the old days, people used to do dissertations that were publishable and often literally radically changed the practice of medicine with these dissertations. What did a German Jewish student in 1740 write to graduate, to fulfill his obligation? Inaugural medical disputation on medicine from the Talmud. Imagine, Germany 1700s. You have a young Jewish student, not too much older than you guys, who's writing about a dissertation on the medicine of the Talmud. One of the very first, there are others of that period of time, but one of the very first discussions of medicine where he went through the Gemara. Now we talked about the importance of anatomical dissection, and we're going to close our remarks in about 5 minutes. What I want to share with you briefly is the ramifications of the new introduction of anatomical dissection into the curriculum. Because once anatomical dissection became an integral part of the curriculum, they have to provide bodies for the medical students. And that was not easy to come by. To give you an idea of how prevalent this was, how did they come by the bodies? Anybody know?
Grave diggers.
Grave robbers. Right. They used to go to the cemeteries and rob the graves. It was so prevalent that Shakespeare's epitaph, when he decided to write on his tombstone, reads as follows. "Good friend, for God's sake, forbear to dig the dust enclosed here. Blessed be ye man that spares these stones, and cursed be he that moves my bones."
No.
Now, I suspect that the people who were doing the grave robbing probably couldn't have read this anyway. But it's fascinating, I'm not going to discuss this now, but there were actually a very, very few cases of Jews who were involved in actual grave robbing. There's a fellow by the name of Israel Chapman who was there's a famous diary of the resurrectionists, they were called. They used to bring the bodies up, resurrectionists. And there was a group of Jews that actually performed grave robbing. We don't want to talk about that. So what did communities do to protect themselves from grave robbing? So I'll share with you. This is one example. This rich Jew, Egi Dematos Mokado, is actually a relative of Moses Montefiore. When he died, he bequeathed 200 guineas to be divided amongst three men appointed to the duty of watching his grave for 12 months after he died to make sure nobody would resurrect his body. Nobody would not resurrect. We want resurrection. We want Tchias Mason, but not this kind of Tchias Mason. But this document is absolutely fascinating. This document I came across just surreptitiously. I was actually doing a Google search on Jews and grave robbing. Some quite interesting stuff that had nothing to do with what I was interested in. But this was in the ER, and I had a few moments, like 3 in the morning on a night shift, and I came across a hit from a library in the south of England, and it said manuscript related to Jews and grave robbing. So it's 3 in the morning. By us, it's 8 in the morning, 9 in the morning in England. So I type an email to the librarian. By the time I finished my shift, we had corresponded a few times, and this is what she sent me. And what you have here, first of all, can you see the illustrations on the side? What is that?
Skull and crossbones.
Skull and crossbones.
An hourglass at the end of its time.
An hourglass at the end of its time. Very good. Excellent. And this is the written in ink over here, handwritten, Shlomo Schneider. Somulav Agoral, it is now your turn, Shlomo Schneider. Leilech Lishmor beBeit HaChaim. What's Beit HaChaim?
Cemetery.
Euphemism. Beit HaChaim deKehila Seinu. Yom Hei. Deparshas, is Parshas Shira. I wasn't sure which the Tavkuf Nun Hei. Anyone want to figure that out? Mean Blood 8.
51.
From 8 o'clock in night until 7 o'clock in the morning. If you don't want to do Shmira, then you can have somebody else do it. And if you neglect to do Shmira altogether, you're going to have a fine, which is an irrevocable fine. So imagine you lived in the Great Synagogue, and you attended the Great Synagogue. This was part of your communal duty. You have to go watch the graves, maybe once, twice a year, do Shmira from dusk to dawn to make sure the graves weren't grave robbed. What kind of things did they do to prevent grave robbing? So this is an advertisement from the British Gazette from 1822. It reads, many hundred dead bodies will be dragged from their wooden coffins this winter for the anatomical lectures. The question of the right to inter in iron is now decided. The violation of the sanctity of the grave is said to be needful, meaning it's important for them, for the instruction of the medical pupil, but let each one about to inter a mother, husband, child, or friend say, shall I devote this object of my affection to such a purpose? If not, the only safe coffin is Bridgman's pant wrought iron. Charge the same price as a wooden one, superior substitute for lead. And this is a wrought iron coffin. That's what they used to do. They used to put these things in the ground, lock heavy-duty metal, so that nobody would be able to grave rob. Just very briefly, because this came up this year, John Hunter, who was a famous physician in England in the 1800s, he used to collect famous specimens for his museum. And if you go to England today, the Hunterian Museum, for those of you who have morbid interest in these kinds of things, which I do, should be a stop on your visit. So one of the things that Hunter was famous for, he was famous for grave robbing to get interesting specimens. And there was a man by the name of Charles Byrne, who was one of the tallest people alive at that time, and everybody knew that when he died, John Hunter wanted his body. So this fellow, Charles Byrne, paid a number of people to take his body out to the ocean and drop it in the ocean in a lead coffin. And lo and behold, Hunter found out about it, and he bribed these people. They dropped something else in the lead coffin, and Charles Byrne's body now sits today in the Hunterian Museum. So now there's a movement to restore his body back to the water. They were concerned about Nivel Hames. These guys are really what set the whole thing, changed the whole landscape. There were two fellows by the name of Burke and Hare, of which there's actually now a movie about them, literally this year. These guys actually would kill vagabonds and derelicts and deliver their bodies to the med school for money. That was part of what was done. So Burke, this said his famous phrase, Burke's the butcher, Hare's the thief, and Knox, who's the physician, Knox the man who buys the beef. So he's the one who, and if you look up in the dictionary, they used to smother these people. To Burke became a verb to smother somebody, based on this fellow Burke. Let's close and just to share that the landscape hasn't really much changed in terms of these things. This is 2002, not that long ago. This actually is 92. 50 killed from med school research. So this is in Bogota, Colombia. And the concern about finding bodies for dissection is still with us today, and this is from November of this past year. Shortage of cadavers for students and a growing number of unclaimed bodies is leading to a revival in the 19th century, to giving U.S. medical schools first choice on unclaimed bodies before they are buried at public expense. So these things are the landscape has changed. And those of you who will be attending medical school, there are lots of halachic shilas about anatomical dissection. Some schools have introduced teaching anatomy without cadavers and using the technology that we have, such as these things. This is a vertopsy, virtual autopsy. Even the autopsies, to return to Noda Behuda, and this will close, the Noda Behuda was asked to Shiloh about whether it's permitted to do autopsy or not, and his psak was that it's only permitted to do autopsy if there's a chol lefanenu, if there's somebody who will directly and immediately benefit from the procedure. How that's applied to today has been an interesting discussion, both in terms of autopsies and in terms of organ donation. But in terms of autopsies, you don't really need to do nivul hames. You don't need to desecrate the body to such a great extent, because you could do something like an MRI as an autopsy alternative, or a vertopsy, as it's called, a virtual autopsy, which obviates the entire halachic issue of nivul hames. And if you have to do a needle biopsy of some particular tissue, Rav Moshe Zatzal Paskin that it's permitted to do a needle biopsy. So we can wave bye-bye over there. So just to conclude, we've had an opportunity to briefly discuss the history of the understanding of the human body, the origin of the Ramach Evarim, which still hasn't really met with complete satisfaction as to what Chazal were talking about. The first tshuva that dealt with anatomical dissection and the history of the introduction of anatomical dissection into medical school. Mirtz Hashem, many of you will be attending medical school and will be engaging in these activities firsthand. So I hope it will give you a little bit of perspective. Thank you guys.